Welcome to Shorts Season 3. I'm Jen Thomas. I live in New York City.
And I'm Lizzie Falconer, and I live in Portland, Oregon.
We are two long-distance friends who want to talk about what we're reading.
This podcast is about how reading short stories can show the world through different perspectives. Today we're reading How to Be an Other Woman by Laurie Moore. It was published first in her short story collection, Self-Help, in 1985. You can find the story in bookstores or in PDFs online.
Laurie Moore is the author of the short story collection Self-Help, Like Life, Birds of America, and Bark. She's also written three novels and a children's novel. She has won the O. Henry Award, the Irish Times International Fiction Prize, the Rare Award, the Penn Malamud Award, and the Finn Zinkler Award. She has essentially won so many awards.
How to Be Another Woman is told from the perspective of Charlene, a secretary who finds herself in an affair with a married man. One of the most famous examples of second-person narration, How to Be Another Woman follows Charlene as she navigates her identity as a carefree mistress to a jealous rival. Jen, I'm so excited to be talking about this story on Shorts. Thank you for allowing us to talk about it, because it was my idea. I brought it forward because it's a story I first read in maybe 2010, 2011 in college, and it's been worming its way around my brain ever since. I love Laurie Moore's use of the second person in this story, and I love how the immediacy of it, how wrapped up we feel in Charlene's experience. I love her use of dialogue. I love her use of lists. I love the auxiliary characters. I think it's one of the best short stories ever written. And so I'm so excited for us to be talking about it today.
Whoa.
So knowing how much I love it, what did you think? Because there's only one right answer.
One of the best short stories ever written. How do I follow that? I mean, I did love it. So the good news is I did love this story. I really felt like I just wanted to stay with Charlene. Like, it's probably one of the longest stories we've read. I just wanted to stay with her. I loved being in her world, and that second person makes you feel so almost like you're kind of within her, like within her somehow. And I just wanted to stay. She was funny. She was going through this very sort of intriguing, frustrating, kind of melancholic and darkly humorous emotional journey with this man who was just the worst. And I just loved it. I loved sitting with her through it.
I love the sense of place, the sense of time. And Charlene is like, you know, in your 20s when you do something and you kind of narrate it in your head. You're like, I am doing this. I'm the type of person who does these things. Like, that is what Charlene is doing here. How to Be an Other Woman. She is, we start off, we meet her in the dark streets of New York City. She is having a main character moment. The first few sentences, meet in expensive beige raincoats on a pea soupy night, like a detective movie. First, stand in front of Flotsheim's 57th Street window. Press your face close to the glass. Watch the fake velvet Hummels inside revolving around the wingtips. Some white shoes like your father wears are propped up with the garlands on a small mound of chemical snow. Okay, Charlene, we're with you.
Incredible. She puts us in the middle of what feels like the opening of some noir kind of thriller. Like, I'm just, my imagination was running wild. You know, she talks about how she can see her breath on the glass. And, you know, she talks about, he asks her for a light. And even the matches that she gives him are called like Lucky's Lounge. I mean, it just feels like there should be some sort of lone saxophone playing in the background and like steam 100%. Rising from the sidewalk. Yeah, definitely feels like she's crafting herself in the middle of a movie.
Yeah, you know this is a retrospective look at what happened because just the details she's giving you. He has a nice chuckle, nice fingernails. The two of you glance furtively at each other, shifting feet. I mean, the tension, the moments. They're just waiting for the bus, right?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, this is a woman in the mid-80s waiting for a bus. It's... but the detail of it makes it obviously just feel like it's this momentous moment. It feels like everything's really elongated. All of the detail that's described makes this feel like it's kind of a moment that's like hanging in time. And even her references make it feel timeless. You know, she talks about these other movie stars. She says that he looks like Robert Culp, who I obviously had to Google, but is this guy who was very sort of very handsome, tall, kind of white guy. He was born in like the 30s, so it gives you a sense of kind of how old maybe he is by this point, with that sort of, you know, big kind of quiff hair, and just you just think what is happening. She's in such a kind of, she's created this romantic moment just from her references and the detail that she gives us here.
Yeah, it's so funny because, like, I don't know, the last time I was on a bus a couple weeks ago, some man came up to me really close and just said, "My ex-wife was a redhead." And then he turned and got off the bus. So I am not having these same experiences. I mean, I love this for Charlene.
Things have changed since 1985.
I wondered what you thought of the line on the second page, "What weather?" You hear him sigh, faintly British or upper crust Delaware.
I had a big question for you about this. So knowing, of course, that I don't know where Delaware is, is the Delaware accent, is that like a kind of softer American, or I don't know.
I don't know. As a West Coast American, I'm not very well versed in the like different elite accents of the East Coast, especially. I have no idea what that means. I love the idea that it's faintly British or upper crust Delaware. All that sounds to me is like it's fake. Like it's a fake accent, but I don't know if that's
true. We Brits have very
perfect. Just like you've been faking this accent
the whole time.
This whole time.
You know what it made me think though, when you pulled out that line? It just makes me feel like this guy is so blah. Like, anytime he opens his mouth in this story, it's just to say something really, either really stupid or really dull. Like, mm-hmm. What weather is a pretty bad kind of opening, you know, line, like way to kind of chat up a woman on a bus. And it's one of the first things we hear him say. And it just makes me think like, oh no, this isn't the meeting. It doesn't match with the kind of beautiful romance of the opening paragraphs. He seems a bit boring.
It's very different reading this story in my 30s than like in the nascent days of my 20s when I was like, oh, the romance of it. Now I'm like, this guy is so boring and is bringing nothing to the table. Like, the most interesting thing about him is his boring wife.
Oh, you're already giving the wife some shade. I feel for Patricia.
I don't know Patricia, but that's like his main character feature. He's always, you know, so she says, you know, they go on some dates. After 4 movies, 3 concerts, and 2.5 museums, you sleep with him. It seems like the right number of cultural events.
Can I just say, I love that line, but talk about what's changed since 1985. Or is that just me? What's happening here?
Can you imagine?
That's a lot. That's a lot of dates.
That's a lot.
And it's a lot of culture.
Oh, I was going to say cultural events, but also, also a lot of dates.
It's a lot of dates.
And then he just drops, like, he tells you his wife's name. It's Patricia. She's an intellectual property lawyer. He tells you he likes you a lot, I simply cannot, Jen. He tells you he likes you a lot. Great.
And did he tell her about Patricia after they slept together? I mean, what's the I feel that the chronology is unclear. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he doesn't come off great here.
No.
And then her kind of brushing it off and saying, I'm a very cool person, I am tough, and showing him her bicep, which is a very perceptive precursor to the emoji of the like strong arm that I would obviously send in the 2023 text version of this conversation that I'm having with the married man.
If this was cat person, then
that would just be a series of emojis. But like, she's sort of immediately sort of, she sounds kind of goofy. Like she's not able to match that with the sort of sleek, romantic, cool ideal of those opening paragraphs. When he talks about his wife, it's a bit gawky, kind of her response, which I liked, which made me like her, but it made me also feel for her.
I had to read it a few times to tell if she knew before she slept with him that he had a wife. But the way she glances over it, it's like she's a cool girl. She's trying to show him that she's not like other women. She's another woman.
Yeah.
You know, this is her instructor guide to us about how this happened. I just hate all of his lines, you know?
Yeah.
I love her banter. I think she's quite funny, but he says, I just don't want you to feel uncomfortable about this. And that's when she says hey, I'm a very cool person, I am tough. It's just, he's like checking off the boxes of like maybe quote unquote appropriate behavior, but obviously it's totally inappropriate. He's just kind of appearing to do the right things. I don't like it.
Yeah, he's not great. But after this section comes one of my favorite lines of the whole story. And I think it's so interesting because Moore's writing is so sophisticated that it makes Charlene and this guy's dialogue sound even more out of place within this kind of world of the story. Because the next paragraph, Moore says, when you were 6, you thought mistress meant to put your shoes on the wrong feet. Now you are older and know it can mean many things, but essentially it means to put your shoes on the wrong feet. You walk differently. In store windows, you don't recognize yourself. You are another woman. Some crazy interior display lady in glasses stumbling frantic and preoccupied through the mannequins. And she keeps going. And every time we get into Moore's kind of world, the writing is so rich. And then anytime these two are talking to each other, it's kind of, it's jarring.
It's so good. But essentially it means to put your shoes on the wrong feet.
I love that.
And we start to see that. And this is when we see Charlene start to go from like, I'm cool, I'm tough, to starting to falter a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, she's not acknowledging that she sees this as a problem, but you start to see how this identity, this idea of being another woman weighs on her, changes her perception of herself.
Exactly. It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. So it's this constant, like, there's something wrong with my shoes. Or she says a little bit later, it's like constantly having a book out from the library. Just a set, it's that weight. It's that something doesn't feel right. It's that pressure. And then from this point on, there's a sort of, you're almost in a bit of a kind of roller coaster part of the story. Like things just happen quite fast. We're suddenly meeting frequently for dinner. We're drinking. We find out stuff about him. We sort of, the pace intensifies a little bit after this realization that she is another woman.
As she starts to kind of lose this grip on herself that seemed tenuous at first, on her own identity and who she is and who Charlene is in this world, this mistress title starts to take over. And this is when we see him start bringing up Patricia and these traits of Patricia. We start to see Charlene mirroring them. So he's talking about his work. So boring. Can you imagine sitting? He says, but I'm no good at systems work, he says, staring through and beyond, way beyond the cracked ceiling, figuring out the cost effectiveness of 200 people shuffling 500 pages back and forth across a new 4.5 by 3 foot desk. I'm not an organized person, like Patricia, for instance. She's incredibly organized. She makes lists for everything. It's pretty impressive. Say flatly, dully, what? That she makes lists. That she makes lists? You like that? Well, yes, you know, what she's going to do, what she has to buy, names of clients she has to see, etc. This is if someone said the best part of me, which no one would ever say, that the best part of me is being organized. But I don't know, that's grounds for divorce right there.
I mean, firstly, it would be grounds for divorce. It's like, this is the best thing about this person. And secondly, why are you talking about her at all while you're sleeping with someone else? Like, you're on a date with another person. Like, there's no world where somebody wants to hear about how incredibly organized the other person you're with is.
Yeah.
This is terrible chat.
It's terrible chat. It's terrible chat. And she takes it personally.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, as you would. When someone's bringing this stuff up and bringing up their, like, other partner's good qualities. I just can't get over how literally boring his description of systems analyst was and his description of his wife. But that's the genius of Lori Moore. That's the genius of it. We're in it with Charlene. We understand why Charlene feels. And we're also like, this man is trash.
He is, and there's hints of kind of something deeper, like when they go to the museum, you know, he's good in the museum because he had an art history minor, and then he says in this section where he's talking about being a systems analyst that, like, actually he wanted to be an actor, and, like, there's, like, flashes of sort of, is he more interesting or is he more creative, and then but sort of just enough to make you go, huh. But then he just starts talking about Patricia's list making, and I'm out of there. I'm out of there.
Yeah. And Charlene is not out of there.
No.
She notes that he gets up in the middle of the night and leaves, and she starts making lists.
Yeah.
Immediately. We see it in the writing. Clients to see. Birthday snapshots, scotch tape, letters to TD and mom. She's starting to take on these traits of Patricia. She's starting, even though she's the other woman, she's starting to change. She's starting to change herself.
Yeah, to be like Patricia, because Patricia's all that this guy talks about, it seems like. And then we meet Hilda. How did you feel about Hilda?
Do I love Hilda? I think she's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. Hilda's great. I love Hilda in that moment where she gets the dressing from her sandwich all over her hands. I was like, welcome, Hilda. We'd be good friends.
Absolutely. Because the rest of the story has been, you know, cinematic, and there's, like, love making, and there's movies, and there's cultural events. And then Hilda is a mess. Hilda is a dose of reality. Into Charlene's, like, I'm a mistress, I'm wearing the wrong shoes, I'm like a library book that's forgotten. And then Hilda is there, like, full realism.
Yeah.
Being like, what are you doing, my gal?
But also, like, the fact that Hilda's also had an affair, and then she says something where she says that Charlene reminds her of her sister, and then she can't really see it through. Like, Hilda's chat is excellent and bizarre.
The dialogue, I think this is one of the best dialogues in stories we've read. It just feels so seamless. And we're going from exposition and Charlene's, you do this, to the dialogue between two people, back to lists, and it never feels disjointed.
Yeah.
it really feels like this is the interior life of Charlene and the ways that her thoughts are kind of fracturing and trying to make sense of a situation that she didn't see herself in. She didn't imagine herself to be.
You know, the other thing that I love about the style, which, as you say, it doesn't feel disjointed, but it also, we don't get really color of Charlene's life. We don't hear, interestingly, a lot of her kind of internal monologue. And we never get, like, when she was on her way to work, you know, there's no place setting really, except for these sort of little snapshots. And so the overall style doesn't feel disjointed, but the experience of reading it is quite disjointed, because you suddenly, you're back in bed with her lover, you're at lunch with Hilda, she's making a list. It's interestingly sort of fractured parts of her life. And I think that's part of the reason that I start to kind of go, Charlene, babe, are you okay? Because, you know, there's no sort of everydayness. There's no mundanity. And again, this is the power of the short story. When you strip all of that out, you have to stay with what is the most vital elements of the story to tell. And Moore does this as an absolute master.
Yeah, I think what you're pointing out is so true, because the details she uses in the lists, in the dialogue, is really specifically chosen. And even though it's still lists, there's something about the details that are so specific, they tell a story within themselves. We don't need to hear how exactly she's feeling every moment if we know that she's making lists of all the lovers you've ever had, and tuck it into your pocket, leave it lying around conspicuously. Mm. Somehow you lose it. Make mislaid jokes to yourself. Make another list. Like, these short, quippy descriptions of what she's doing tell you a hell of a lot more about what's going on with Charlene internally than if we had her being like, I wish, you know, I feel so jealous. Maybe if he saw me as wanted by other men, you know, you don't need that.
You don't need it.
We also should call out that one of her lover's names is Ed Rubberhead Cattipano.
Is that a nickname she gave him? Or is that, I mean, I have a lot of questions.
Do we need more nicknames?
Also, I like that she wrote Charles Dietz or Keats, because she doesn't remember his name. I just have a lot of respect for Charlene.
I just love that. That tells us so much.
Yeah.
And the last name, we don't even have a person's last name. So, like, you get a sense, okay, she slept with four people. Half of them, she didn't even know their last name. So we can make a guess that, like, it's probably been a while since Charlene has had a meaningful, like, relationship with someone. And so she's attracted to this man, even if he is so boring and won't shut up about his wife.
That's a great list. I just also love that she just started, like, you know, like, leaving it around. It's such She's, like, in her own play. Yes. And you know that this guy has noticed fuck all. Like, there's nothing worse than when you're, like, trying to, like, get someone to notice you and they just do not care. It's just one of the most heartbreaking feelings of all time. It's like, oh, I've just gone upstairs to change into this brilliant new outfit and you don't, either haven't noticed or have noticed and don't care. And both of them are extremely hurtful. It's like, she's just having this every day, every time she sees this guy.
Who among us? I remember going on a date in college and I picked out this very specific dress and I got really dressed up and I went to this bar and there was a bunch of people there and I was trying to see one guy. And I remember later in the night, I overheard him say, "Do you see her? She wore that dress for me." I know. It eviscerated me. Like, to be seen, like, to be seen that transparently and then have it be, like, not reciprocated and disrespected. I mean, Oh, tough.
I felt that very deeply, what you just said. That's worse than it not being seen. Is it being seen? Oh,
is it
no.
being seen and disrespected? And or like, oh, it was so... I still see pictures of that dress and it hurts me. Yeah.
Don't mean to laugh, but...
No, it's funny.
That's a deep cut.
It's so funny. It's just how this story makes me feel. And the just details of it, you know, she starts going into heavy detail about when he's leaving the bed and she whispers, don't go yet. And she's talking about what it smells like. Watch him again pull on his pants, his sweater, his socks and shoes. Every single detail of this experience, she's like laying out how every single thing hurts. She's seeing every single moment. And at the end of that, she just says, wonder who you are. She's just so lost in it. She's so lost in him. She can't see herself anymore.
Yeah. And again, like, talk about experiences that we can relate to. When you just, when there's a real yearning and you're not, it's not being reciprocated, it is so destabilizing because everything you're doing is about the other person. It feels like it's all one-way traffic. So by the end of it, you're spent and she's just not being seen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And then, you know, but the affair goes on and, you know, the next time that she sees him, she's downs two massive glasses of wine.
Relatable.
And you just think, oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's down two glasses of wine. Like, things start falling apart. She starts being unhappy with him. And literally, she puts us back in the same place she was where she first met him. Wait freezing in front of Florsheim's until 7:20. He finally dashes up. So, like, the shine of this romance is starting to wear off. She's starting to be frustrated. And he invites her to his house.
Yeah, which is a very grim step for everybody. I mean, it just seems horrible for everybody, apart from him, probably. You know, I'm sure Patricia wouldn't want her there. And, you know, Charlene is just in this double world, this kind of mirror world where... She's suddenly close to everything that is hers. These photos of this woman, her clothes, her shoes, her toothbrush. I mean, there's a whole scene where she's in the bathroom and she says, imagine a wife and a mistress sharing the same toothbrush forever and ever. I mean, she is just spinning out at the house. Mm-hmm. And she you know, lists everything in the medicine cabinet and then... By the time she leaves, she is now living in this world where she thinks she sees this woman everywhere. It really damages her, the experience of going to her house and sleeping in her bed.
Yeah, she's like, right, this identity crisis is coming to a head. This man, this relationship doesn't even seem fun to her anymore, but she is in it. It feels like, I don't know, if maybe it feels like she's already gone too far. It's hard for me to know why she's staying in it. Do you get the sense that she's in love with him?
No, not from her description of him. You know, she's not describing him the way that you would imagine somebody would in their kind of interior monologue. It's, you know, she's not sort of saying... Look at him and realize how lucky you are, like anything. And she doesn't, you know, even when she's describing him kind of more positively, there's a point where she talks about his laugh. And I thought that was really interesting because she's not talking about how he's funny. She talks about how making him laugh makes her feel good. So it's just this power imbalance that's sort of keeping her... keeping her kind of wanting more of him because she can't get enough. He can't give her any of him, really. He's leaving in the middle of the night and not calling her for a week at a time.
Oh, it's so painful. Yeah. It's like she gets involved in it because she likes how it makes her feel. And she likes it first, being like coquettish and young. And she's the other woman. And then slowly, everything becomes painful.
Yeah.
Every moment becomes painful with this man. And then suddenly, we're in her parents' house for Christmas.
Yeah, that sort of, what are you doing for Christmas, suddenly feels like, wait, what? Like, it's a very sort of mundane conversation that we haven't really had before, which is genuinely just about them. And yeah, it's Christmas time, we're meeting her parents. This was a real surprise.
What a scene. Came out of nowhere, wasn't expecting it. And she's talking to her mom, and she's talking about how she gives her mom a present. And she's looking at her mom and she says, she kisses you wetly on the cheek, a Christmas mist in her eyes. She thinks you're wonderful. She's truly your greatest fan. She is aging and menopausal. She stubbornly thinks you're an assistant department head at Karma Cola. She wants so badly, so earnestly to be you. Do you think that's true? Or do you think this is a 20-year-old who truly thinks she's the center of the world? Because I feel like there's some misunderstanding in her interaction with her mom, but I'm not sure.
That's a really interesting question. I kind of took it at face value because I think sometimes parents do see their children in just the most extraordinary light and just think that they're the absolute best. But I think that the line about wants so badly to be you feels so interesting. And actually, I hadn't thought of it, but as you're talking, you know, maybe that's just a judgment on her mom that we're hearing, that she thinks, of course, mom would want to be me because mom's life is whatever. It could be read that way for sure.
I guess I thought that because when this admission comes out to her mom pretty quickly that she's with this married man, you know, her mother kind of loses it. She says, you're asking for big trouble. And then she says, she looks up at you, her mouth trembling, pieces of her brown gray hair dangling in her salty eyes, pink silverware cream caking onto her hands, onto her wedding ring. She stops, puts a spoon down, looks away, and then hopelessly back at you like a very young girl, and shaking her head, bursts into tears. And I wasn't sure if that was either Charlene's mother being very disappointed in her, or if it indicated that something had happened in Charlene's parents' own marriage. And like for her to see her daughter playing that role, I just wasn't sure. I just thought it was a very extreme reaction.
That's a really astute reading. And I think we don't know. And I love that we don't know. But it doesn't feel like a mom who is wishing that she was Charlene. That section.
No, it seems like Charlene is, although she's paying such close attention to every detail, missing the big picture.
Yeah, which feels like similar to what we're seeing in her relationship as well. The part just after this, so we get this kind of slightly strange, very separate scene with her parents. And then she sees this man again. And I hated this line. I missed you, he practically shouts, ebullient and adolescent, pacing about the living room with a sort of bounce, like a child who is up way past his bedtime and wants to ask a question.
Disgusting.
I felt so disgusted by that. Because you just know it's a fucking strutting, like, guy who wants to get his end away. That's what it feels like. Like, I haven't seen you for a couple of weeks and now I just want to fuck you. And like, suddenly I care and I'm like boyish because all I can think about is my penis. That's all it made me feel.
Yeah, 100%. Ugh. 100%.
I just wrote in my notes, ugh.
Next. Yeah, it reminds me of in Broad City. Have you watched much Broad City?
I've not. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, Jen, now that you're a New Yorker, we got to get you on Broad City.
Okay.
It's a comedy show with two female comedians who are hilarious. And they have a scene where Fred Armiston, they've gone over to his house and he's paying them to clean. And he like asks them to take off more and more clothes. And in the end, they're like, you're weird. We got to get out of here. And he comes out wearing like a baby diaper. And he's like, they're like, you have to pay us because we cleaned your house. And he's like, but I'm just a baby.
Oh,
but I'm just a baby. And they're like, oh my God, this is horrible. Get out of here. And that's what it reminded me of. It's like in the previous page, this man had kind of patted her on the hand and been like, no, Charlene, I can't come meet your parents. And now he's like a young, fun boy. It's just, I don't like it. I don't like any of it.
No. And then it's very weird and patronizing, the sort of the scene that unfolds. And it's a very weird scene because this is the scene that ends with him saying, I'm going to tell Patricia about us. And I was quite impressed that our girl Charlene was like, I think it describes her as skeptical. But then as the conversation plays out, he just completely backtracks and he says, you know, when she challenges him and says, well, you know, what will you say if she'll start weeping inconsolably? And he says, I'll tell her I was just kidding. And it's like, oh, cool. Like what? And again, in like the sparse time that we have in a short story, how brilliant of Moore to give us this scene where nothing moves forward or backwards here. We just deeply hate this man more. that's what she's given us.
Yeah. What an absolute wimp. And it's wild that he's honest. I just thought that felt like a really real moment because she's calling him on it. Like,
yeah.
And he just says, I'll tell her, I'm just kidding. This reveal, I think she sees that this is how it's always going to be. And it sends her tumbling.
I was going to say, because the next section is like the most unhinged experience that we have through the whole story. So this is a section where she thinks he might come round, even though he said like, oh, you know, I'll try and make it, but there's no guarantee. And then she, just in case, spends 2 hours showering, dressing, applying makeup unrecognizably like someone in drag. And then as it is late and you have to work the next day, climb onto your bed like that, wearing perfume and an embarrassing, long, flowing, lacy bathrobe that is really not a bathrobe at all, but a hostess lounge coat. It's horrible. And then because she's left the door unlocked for him, there's this incredible sentence. 6 blocks from 14th Street, you are risking your life for him, spread out like a ridiculous cake on the bed, waiting with the door unlocked. A ridiculous cake.
Oh, it's just like this small threat of violence. Mm. Any story we ever read that has ever to do with anything about being a woman, there's always a note in it that indicates the small threat of violence or the threat of violence that lurks. And I just thought that was like a masterful way to include that, the vulnerability.
Yeah.
Because there's two types of vulnerabilities in this scene. There's a vulnerability if she is like, she would do anything for him. She is not herself. She is giving everything, her time, her energy, making herself look different, everything for the hope that this man will give her attention. And then there's like her literal physical vulnerability of leaving the door unlocked. She is like cracked open. She has cut herself open for this man and he's like left her high and dry. God damn it.
So, and I feel like that's this area, it feels like a turning point because beyond this section and this sort of chapter, because that feels like that doesn't just happen once, like that feels the way it's written, it feels like it's something that maybe happens a handful of times. And then suddenly again, she goes on a date with someone else and then things really start to, it feels like things start to really change.
Yeah, I love how Moore shows us these up and downs of this relationship, like from she's leaving this list of men's names around. She's telling him about being asked out at this dance over Christmas. She's literally going on a date with someone. Like, we're seeing them follow familiar patterns, but it always feels fresh the way that Moore tells it. It always, you really feel like the undulations of this relationship.
Yeah.
But yeah, then we then we see her really turn. She's really marking time. She says, cut up an old calendar into week-long strips. Place them around your kitchen floor, a sort of bar graph on the linoleum, representing the number of weeks you have been a mistress. 13. Put X's through all the national holidays. She's trying to make it concrete. She feels like this relationship is not real, or something about it feels like she can't grasp onto it. And she's literally trying to make it something physical she can see, because he's not there. That's a great detail.
Yeah. I love the way you're describing it as something that she needs to see. Because when I first read that section, I thought, is this her sort of taking a step back and sort of judging herself, or trying to sort of fathom it? Because also the exes through the national holidays, it's obviously time that they didn't spend together. So it's like, is she not counting that time? How is she counting the time? There was so much in that, in those details. But it's interesting that you're saying, you know, this is a manifestation of a relationship that otherwise she cannot grasp. There's no way to hold on to it.
I just wonder if she's trying to understand the devastation that she feels, like how devastating, like she's trying to match up her emotions to the time and the experience because it's been so destabilizing. I love her next list, because you can tell she's like using some stationery from work, because it's like clients to see at the top. But then number one, this affair is demeaning. 2, violates decency. Am I just some scampish tart, some tartish scamp? 3, no emotional support here. 4, why do you never say I love you or stay in my arms forever, my little tadpole, or your eyes set me on fire, my sweet nubkin?
It's so good. It is so good. And that last one, I was like, maybe that's a quote. Like, you know, because at the beginning she's reading Madame Bovary, and I was like, maybe these are quotes from some literary something. And I Googled it, and I just ended up in like a tadpole, like dark space in the internet where people were talking about their tadpoles and like whether they were growing and how many tadpoles have become frogs. I was like, how have I ended up here? This is some deep.
Like, what is this deep literary references? And then you're like, oh, the gestation of tadpoles.
It's just funny. I mean, it's just funny writing. But it's interesting what you say about clients to see, because I don't think that's her office stationery. I think that that's one of the lists that Patricia made. She's always making lists, he says at the beginning.
Oh, so she's like, oh, literally copying.
She just writes clients to see, and then she makes a totally different list. And it comes up a few times, like she's got clients to see at the top of the list. And it's just,
she's trying to be an adult in some ways. She's like trying to mimic.
She's like, I can do it too, but I don't have any clients because I work in this secretary job that I don't like. And so, yeah, it's so good. The details are so good.
It's so good. And then we get to like the real surprise. They're having a conversation. They're talking on the phone, and she makes a joke, and she says, he laughs, smooth, beautiful, and tenor, making you feel warm inside of your bones. And it hits you. Maybe it all boils down to this. People will do anything for a really nice laugh. And then she confronts him about how she's feeling.
Yeah.
And that he doesn't care about her. And he's like, well, what can I do, Charlene? Stand on my goddamned head? And she says, please, stand on your goddamn head. And he says, it's 10 o'clock. I'm coming over. We need to talk. And I thought, because I'd forgotten, oh, he's coming over for some romantic overture. He's going to try to win her back, make her happy. But no.
No, no. The twist in the tale. It's not Patricia. So Patricia is another woman. Patricia's a mistress. Carrie is his wife. And she realizes and says to him, you mean I'm just another one of the fucking gang?
Unbelievable response. I mean, good on her. That's an incredible thing to say back. And he looks at her like some big dumb baby and says, Charlene, what I've always admired about you right from when I first met you is your strength, your independence.
Blech.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
The audacity.
He's awful. But then I'm so impressed with Charlene. I'm not going to lie. I thought at this point, having not read the story before, I was like, oh no, she's going to sort of start to try and get him back or try and like win him over from these other women. And you realize actually she does have strength and she does have independence because she tells him not to smoke in her apartment. She tells him to get out. And then he leaves. She slams the door like Betty Davis. Thank you. We're back to like her sort of feeling like she's this incredible sort of movie star. And that moment is really empowering. You feel like she's really empowered. And obviously it doesn't last. She has these feelings that, I mean, it just sounds horrible, just so empty. It says, love drains from you, takes with it much of your blood sugar and water weight. You are like a house slowly losing its electricity, the fans slowing, the lights dimming and flickering, the clocks stop and go and stop. Just a sense of a kind of draining from her as she realizes everything and she can't sort of cope with it and everything becomes aimless and lost. But then it turns again. She does have so much strength. She is powerful. Just like she told us she was at the beginning.
She's strong. Bicep emoji. That writing, that's that line, those lines, the love drains from you and the description of the house is like the type of writing that makes you want to go lay down because it's so good. It's just like, oh, a feeling that I've never been able to describe before. And Lori Moore nails it on the head, you know, like she's hitting me in the heart with a hammer. Like, there it is. It's so good.
Yeah.
And part of me wonders, you know, she has for the whole story is the agony of this. And then we get one paragraph of how it feels, how the breakup feels. And then she's kind of back into it. And I wonder, I don't know this to be true, but I wonder if part of her love for this relationship was being the mistress. And when that's taken away from her, when she's just one of many,
yeah,
she's not just the other woman. She's another woman. She's not the one. She's another woman. It loses its appeal for her. It loses its sexiness. She sees it in such a different light that she's able to kind of detach and move forward.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because it's not, yeah, that's not the response you think it's going to be. And I like that. If that is what the turning point is for her, then like, good on you, really. It's like, I won't be one of the gang. I want to be the one who's better than your wife, right? Like, that's the feeling, or she seems to be looking for at the beginning.
Yeah. I think, I don't know if that reading is right, or if she's actually devastated, and the scene at the end where he's calling her occasionally and she's telling him she's fine is like an indication of the toll that this actually took on her. But I do prefer the reading, you know, where she being one of many shocks her out of this kind of dreamland.
Because, I mean, he was always, you know, had a wife and was sleeping with someone else. So that sort of moral transgression, if that's what it is not, that's not bad for her. You know, she's always known that she was the other woman. So I do think there's something in that reading. There's also one thing I loved about the very end where in her kind of getting back to normal, she gets a raise and she starts to write to graduate schools and you're like, oh yeah, her life is kind of moving forward. I love that she sends Mark, the banker, who's the guy she went on a kind of normal medium date with, a birthday card, because I was like hard relating to that. You know, when a relationship breaks down and then you're immediately like, let me text this person who I haven't seen for 3 years, but who I slept with that one time. I was like, she called it.
Yeah, I love it. I love this story. I'll say that it, like, you know, when I first read it, when I was 19 or 20, it kicked off a very long period of writing in my journal in second person. So I have just these like endless journal entries with the little details I was noticing at the time because I was trying to copy this style. And I just, like, it's very endearing to go back to the original text and be like, what was I trying to capture at that point in my life? What was I trying to mimic? Because I think a lot of it was similar to what Charlene was, where your life feels, who you are feels in flux, your life feels really different, and the only way you're trying to figure out the next steps are to, like, pay as close attention as possible. These details matter. The things this person is saying matter. They mean something bigger. And I just love this story. It's just a masterclass.
Yeah, it really is. And I love also that feeling that is captured of being able to kind of construct your identity when you're that age, or, you know, when you're having these kind of first flashes of romance and it's like she didn't know what a mistress was and now she's kind of creating it and embodying it, and she sort of builds that out for herself. It's almost like she molds it in clay. And it comes with like unexpected emotional pain, because that's what happens when you are in your 20s and you're having these experiences and you're sleeping with men who are just awful. But it also comes with a sort of sense of strength and a sense of eventually who she is and who she's able to be. And I love how Laurie Moore manages to capture so much of that with so little exposition or so little additional explanation of what's going on, but it just feels so rich. And I loved it. I loved sitting with Charlene for these months that she is having these experiences.
These 13 weeks plus. Thanks for reading with me, Jen.
Thanks for reading with me, Lizzie.